Hi, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Professor Tony Birch, a Melbourne-based historian, novelist, short story writer, poet, and public intellectual. Tony trained in Aboriginal history at the University of Melbourne, where his PhD won the Chancellor's Prize for Excellence in 2003. During the early 2000s, Tony was deep in the trenches of the history wars, and his work helped prosecute the case for greater recognition of Australia's frontier wars and the ongoing dispossession of its first peoples. More recently, however, Tony has concentrated his energies on fiction. His first novel, Blood, was shortlisted for the 2011 Miles Franklin Award, and Ghost River won the 2016 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Indigenous Writing. Tony's also published several short story collections, most recently Common People, which came out in 2017. His latest novel, The White Girl, was published in June 2019. Tony has taught both history and creative writing at the University of Melbourne and is currently a senior research fellow at Victoria University. Welcome to Archive Fever, Tony.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to talk about your latest book in a little while, but first, like good historians, let's go back to where it all began. I believe you started formally studying history as a uni student in the late 1980s. But was that when you first got interested in the research process, or were you bitten by the research bug earlier on?
It's interesting because, particularly thinking of my later poetic work, there's an American poet, Charles Reznikoff, who was a Russian Jewish writer in the early 20th century, and he wrote what he called a two-volume history of America called Testimony, where he worked on court transcripts and court records. And that was a really influential book for me as a poet. And for a Melbourne-based poet who people will probably know really well, Pio Reznikoff is someone who took the court records and the archive and in a sense got it to speak in a different way to write what is essentially a people's history. And there are other poetic works that I've been influenced by similar to that. So Geordie Orbiston's The Hanging of Jean Lee, for instance, is a remarkable book about the last woman who was hung for murder in Victoria, where Geordie used newspaper records, court transcripts, children's nursery rhymes, and that was also a very influential work. And I knew both of those works before I studied, but my main interest in history as an archive addict began in 1988 when I went to Melbourne University and studied history first year, and a lot of that history was based on archival work, particularly looking at 19th century British, Australian and colonial history, and I really got the bug very early on.
And what did having the bug feel like for you? What did it kind of feel to be in the grip of Archive Fever?
Quite interesting because, you know, the traditional historians or the what we call the aristocracy of the history profession, which are usually sort of older men, they have a very particular notion of the archive as a sort of a fact-finding exercise and a truth-telling exercise. And what I enjoyed more about the archive was, I think it's actually surreal in some way. So you go to it looking for the facts of the past and you find the most incredibly outlandish material. It was great copy to work with. And I remember one of my PhD supervisors at one point said, you just want to tell a good story. That's the only reason you've introduced this source. But he was accurate to an extent. I felt that there was something about the archive that told a really rich story, but it wasn't for me something that I wanted to produce data from, for instance, or to simply use the archive to underpin the foundations of truth that we already knew.
Tony, your PhD was a history of Fitzroy, where you had grown up yourself. What archival sources were you mostly looking at for that?
I had really great access to newspaper archives, and that was by accident. I went into the Herald Sun one morning, who had a remarkable clippings library, which wasn't open to the public or even to researchers. And they were about to say that I couldn't use it. And then for some reason, the chief librarian asked me my name. And then he asked if I was the son of Brian Birch. And the guy who was running the library was an old friend of my dad's who'd gone to school with me. They actually gave me a desk in the Herald Sun, gave me access to all the clippings, which are all itemized under headings, and gave me access to the photocopier. So I was literally able to range through things like police arrests, arrest of police, prostitution, rat stories. I'm fascinated by rat stories. So I probably got access to material that I dealt with within 6 months that probably would have taken someone working with microfilm years and years. So that was a rich source. The Fair Rents Board material was really rich because people would go to the Fair Rents Board seeking either a decrease in their rent or a landlord seeking an increase. The court records were so rich because they would have an inventory of, say, with boarding houses. They would itemize every bit of furniture in the house down to sort of knives and forks. So that was really helpful. Probably the richest was the Citizens Welfare Service, which I did a chapter on social work. And I found that material both the richest and the most absurd. The social work profession in Australia, particularly in Victoria, professionalised itself after the war, and the rhetoric of the social work profession was to go against the notion of subjective judgment, to go to a professional social worker as opposed to a friendly visitor or what were called in those days a charity queen. But what I found was that highly educated or educated social workers who were coming out of Melbourne University as the first university-based social work course were not only as subjective in their judgments as anyone else had been, but quite crazy in their behaviours. You wouldn't think that a social worker in the 1960s would actually break into someone's house and or climb through a window to do a job on someone. They would interview neighbours. They were really spies. They worked as spies. And it was remarkable to what extent they would misread women in particular, misjudge women, and privilege particular people in society.
And what do you think that it meant being working class yourself, growing up in housing commission, your family potentially accessing that welfare, to be embedded in those archives?
A lot of material I didn't find surprising. So the judgments of women I didn't find surprising. I knew that through growing up amongst women who had to deal with social workers every day and how women would strategically prepare for a social worker's visit. So that social workers, their most detrimental judgment would be of a woman who answered the door smoking a cigarette, for instance. If a woman answered the door smoking a cigarette, she was in serious trouble. The women, though, who were most vulnerable in the sense of possibly having their children removed or their lives interfered with the most, were actually the women who were the most compliant. And I understood that as well, so that my mother would adopt an attitude to social workers, which would be, you understood about, you know, making sure there was food in the fridge and the house was clean, but you wouldn't simply invite a social worker into your house, and women would have to stand firm, which would put the social worker off. The saddest cases in those archives, there are women who are very compliant at the outset, and as I started to read more and more, so I actually read every case file for Fitzroy from 1944 to 66, which is about 450 case files, and by the time I'd read about 100, you could see a pattern. You'd get really thick, heavy files. You'd pull it out and you'd think, okay, here's a woman who's going to have a 10-year investment with this organisation. And as you began to read it and you'd find the social worker that on the first visit might help rearrange the furniture and gradually involve herself in a woman's life more and more, you realise that this is going to end badly. And in often those cases, you would end up having children removed from family. And people might think it would be the opposite. A social worker comes in, sees what they consider to be dirt or people being sort of lumpen, undeserving working class. It was much more likely that if a woman was compliant that she would be caught in this trap of a client-social worker relationship. So for me, though, there are little surprises. Probably the most difficult issue was that I started to recognise names and I had to be very careful about that so that there are families that I knew. One of the interesting things is that there are Aboriginal families that I knew who were never recognised by the social workers as Aboriginal people and didn't volunteer that, which I think is interesting and really important, because they certainly knew that if they volunteered that sort of information, they would also be more likely to have their children removed. So that was an insight that I suspected, and yeah, that was one that was supported by the research.
That's obviously, I mean, a lot of very distressing material that you were dealing with, you know, over 400 of these case files with, you know, many cases of child removal. And I know it wasn't kind of news to you, but to read that day after day, you know, it's heavy going. I mean, do you feel like that kind of research can be a traumatic experience?
Not in that case. I didn't, yeah, actually. And in fact, I would say that my PhD is really rock solid on research. And each time that I presented my research, particularly that social work chapter, which I did at a brown bag at the University of Melbourne, the staff seminar series, and also at a social work conference, people actually didn't believe it. And the sort of questions I was getting, like, why would you present a biased sample? And I'd say, well, in fact, I've read every file, and I could, if, you know, that case of a woman having her children taken, there were 10 cases I could have mentioned. So that it was very difficult and frustrating to convince people of what you might call the legitimacy of the research. And clearly what they were doing also is linking, he's an insider, as Claire just talked about, so therefore he's got an internal bias. So with all of the chapters in that thesis, I ensured that any example that I used about whether it be police behaviour, social work behaviour, that it wasn't an aberration or it wasn't an exaggeration, it was part of a pattern of behaviour. The most traumatic experience I had was, in fact, looking at early 19th century archive, looking at the murder of Aboriginal people in the Western District of Victoria. So my first published essay was an essay on a name restoration project for the Garrywood Mountain Range in the Western District. And one of the issues there was a refusal by contemporary settler society people to recognise that not only that Aboriginal people had lived in the area for thousands of years, but had been suffered brutal massacres there. So what I did in that case was to go back to the source of the colonial archive, and particularly George Augustus Robinson, after he'd been appointed Chief Protector of Aborigines in Victoria in the colony. And in Robinson's diary, he documents atrocity after atrocity. And towards the end of his tour through the Western District, he gets a report of a child who'd been burnt alive on a fire, thrown on a fire by a squatter community. And in the line after that, Robinson writes in his diary, who was never a great friend of Aboriginal people, this would not be allowed in a civilised society. He was just outraged. I did that research for months, and people did say to me, oh, this must be really traumatic. And I said, no, I'm just doing what has to be done, because I like to answer back in that sort of sense. And then I was invited to a conference called Postcolonialism with a question mark, and mine was the last paper of the day, and I was up the front and I gave the paper, and I still remember some Aboriginal women friends of mine, the late Lisa Blair and a couple others, were sitting up the front, and it was a long paper. It was about 40 minutes and it was really hot in the room and really crowded, and there was all these big rock star postcolonial academics, and I just thought, this needs to be told. So I got to the end of the paper and I repeated those words. Robinson could only write the obvious. This would not be allowed in the civilized society. And as soon as I said that, I looked up and Lisa goes, oh no. And I just burst into tears. Luckily, there was a door going out the back and we went out the back. The worst thing about that, it wasn't the crying I can cry on at the drop of a hat. It was that the moment was sort of lost, so then all the white fellas in the room, they felt sorry for me, whereas I didn't want them to feel sorry for me. I wanted them to feel implicated by what I read. That caught up with me. And I know that a lot of Aboriginal people who do research on that issue or on family history, it is very traumatic. So I'm supervising a student at the moment who's looking at the theft of her own grandmother, and she's got to look at photographs from children's homes. Her grandmother was given a number or a new name, and there's a photograph of two children, and the student said to me, that's my name with her brother. And I said, well, if there's any consolation, I suppose they were together. She goes, well, except that they never knew they were related. No one told them. And she never found her brother again, so she was in the home with him as a child, and they didn't even know they were related because they'd been taken at different times. So, and when she told me that, the emotion was so palpable. So I think the courage of Aboriginal people, particularly a lot of women are doing this research, they wouldn't separate their emotional response from the intellectual response. And they will really front people about that and saying, yeah, we're not going to separate our emotional intelligence from our intellectual intelligence.
Tony, you've mentioned a photograph there, and you've used historical photographs as important archives in your research, and you've reflected and written about photography a lot. It's been said that visual culture can be an empowering way of understanding the past, particularly for Indigenous people. But empowering for who? The people in the photographs or their descendants?
I think photography is really complex in what it can tell because, yeah, there are all sorts of issues about agency, there are issues about setting, there are issues about motivation, and they're what I would call the currency of the photograph. So one of the issues for my PhD work is that there was a photograph, a very famous photograph of a brother and sister, Millie and Billy, or Millie and Nilly. And it said, in a back lane in Fitzroy, yeah, they took the photograph in classic slum photography in front of an open drain, bare feet. So it fits all the motifs of 19th century slum photography from Britain and the US. But what was interesting, when I first saw the photograph, it was presented, you know, as photographs were, as irrefutable evidence of deviance. And then you see the photograph, it reappears in different magazines with different names in different suburbs. So it's a fiction. But each time it appears as an authentic evidence of degeneracy. So it was very potent. And in the 19th century, photography was sometimes given the same forensic status as we might think of fingerprints or even DNA. So had very real authority, but it was incredibly suspect, incredibly biased. So any time I look at those sort of photographs, I do look at them with a lot of suspicion, or certainly they need to be interrogated. I think in regard to the archive for Aboriginal people, there are issues of discovery, of course, that you can find. There's a wonderful photographic series called the Seeger Collection. A Swedish guy, Richard Seeger, who came to Australia and became a friend of Sir Pastor Doug Nichols. Seeger took about 200 photographs at Jackson's Track, which was in the east of the state, and that was part of the great walk-off from Lake Tyres, and an Aboriginal community set up an autonomous camp at Jackson's Track for about 10 years. It is interesting to see the Aboriginal people in those photographs in a state where they obviously feel comfortable with the photographer and comfortable with the fact that Seeger is a mate of Pastor Doug. And there's a warmth in those photographs that I've not seen in the Victorian archive. So the Seeger collection is a good collection to put alongside an institutional collection to see how people present themselves. But I do think that visual culture is really important, but you have to engage with it as critically as any other source, and it's very loaded because I think photographs hold great emotional resonance, and you can be lured into reading them in a particular way that I think gives you false comfort.
Tony, I think, you know, one of the most interesting things about your career is your sort of journey from being a historian to mainly kind of working in fiction. But so often your fiction is very historical, and I believe you've written that I felt I could portray history with equal validity as a poet and a fiction writer. Can you sort of unpack for us how your relationship to kind of historical research and historical archives has evolved as you've moved more towards fiction?
Yeah, I mean, that quote I think is from a conversation between Bain Attwood and Dipesh Chakrabarty. It's a bit misconstrued. I think Bain made that point to try and say, I don't do history anymore. Historians always like to say, well, we're historians and this person does that, which is different. There's quite something quite tangible here, though. So Claire mentioned about being involved in the so-called history wars. I had read the Royal Commission into Corranderk, which had 1881, where William Barrack, an Aboriginal man, was interviewed about his life at Corranderk. He had had a terrible experience where his son David was dying, and his son had to go to hospital, and William was allowed to go with David to Melbourne from Corranderk near Healesville to Melbourne, but he was put off the stagecoach in Richmond. He carried his son through the streets. He went to the hospital, and he wasn't even allowed to go into the hospital. David was taken from him, and then William never saw him again, never got his body returned. His son died and William went back to Corranderk. If you read the Royal Commission document, they ask William some really banal questions like, how many undershirts does he get each year? Is he well fed? What I realised at that time is that it wasn't the questions that were asked of William Barrack, which would find their way into an archive that we might go and research, but there were so many questions that they didn't ask him. So when I started to do that archive series in poetry, part of the motivation was to ask the questions that weren't asked. So the fact that someone would ask this Aboriginal elder and artist and leader if he had an undershirt, but not ask him, how did you feel when you weren't able to see your son in the hospital? How did you feel when your son's body was taken from you? I decided I wanted to interrogate the archive in a different way. And that came out of the dissatisfaction with that whole history wars debacle, which was supposedly around, you know, the history profession again arguing over footnotes. Me saying, well, it's something much more than a footnote. And the offence that I took was that those who were opposing the right on this issue, so in other words, so what some people call the left aristocracy of the history profession, their response to the history wars was incredibly conservative, incredibly insular and self-protective. They kept talking about the professional standards. And I think one of the things that people don't understand about the history wars, which I tried to explain to Professor Stuart McIntyre one time, this is not an intellectual debate. It's a political gutter fight. And if you're not prepared to get down the gutter with these right-wing head kickers, you should get out, which they didn't, of course. So they were defending a profession rather than understanding this is a much more heightened political battle.
So your series of poems, Archive Box, I believe, uses some of the archival material that was being fought over in the history wars, but kind of uses it in a more direct and poetic way.
Yeah.
Would you be able to read some of that?
Yeah,
poem?
So I did four of them.
Mm.
The second and third ones are probably the more poetic. The problem with them is that the first and the fourth one, they were published in law journals and people thought they were just literal, so they didn't get the joke. So this is from archive box number 2, footnote to a history war, section 5. He wears a suit, issue number 6, hat, issue number 7, and possesses one pair of blankets. She has on loan one mullet net and two perch nets. Their children are gone, one influenza, one pneumonia, one ditto. 6. I am nearly bootless and my colour is a curse, too white, too dark. I am to be recommended within Unit 4, Subfile 3, for license renewal. I am to be approved by you via Certificate Number 71, herewith, in this body, within me, within me.
So what do you think you were trying to do to the archive in these poems? Like, could they be described as an effort to decolonise the archive or just to read it differently?
I think with this one, this is set up in a very particular way where there are 10 stanzas and it's like a call and response. So that each one what you might call the voice of the archive, the second one is the voice of Aboriginal people in response. So looking at the archive there in particular, it was looking at what you might call the sterile bureaucratic voice of some archival material, like just counting people, counting shirts. So in other words, if you go to those annual reports of the Welfare Board or the Protection Board, you see a count, and the count will literally count people, count sheep, count cows, count nets, and they're just still there as part of the one inventory. With the response, what I wanted to do is say, hang on, I want to give depth to this banality or respond in a way that is quite different. So when someone dies of pneumonia and then the second one is ditto, that says a lot about the inability of the archive or the people writing that document to humanise it. And later on in that poem, I mean, literally there would be reports of how many bushels of tea are in store, how many sheep were slaughtered, how many lambs were born, and how many Aboriginal people died, all in the one column.
Yeah.
They talk about a child dying because the church holds an outside service because the church had burnt down, but everything is a passing reference. So what I'm trying to do is implicate and interrogate those comments to people to see, well, there's something really damaging going on here. And also, what does it say about that type of archive which refuses to engage with the human condition? You do have to make it respond in a way that it doesn't want to. So it is prizing the archive open and demanding that it speak.
Tony, do you think in general that historians are too reverential towards the archive? Do we fetishise it? Should we in general be showing not just curiosity but a great deal of doubt?
Yeah, I did a PhD in history, and I regard it as a vital discipline. I took my PhD very seriously, and again, I think it would stand up to any interrogation as its representation of the past. I still believe that even with the sort of discussions of, you know, what we might call post-structuralist, post-modernist views of history, which we both were taught, there's in fact a defensiveness and a conservativeness within the profession. It still shuts itself off from the rest of the humanities world in some ways. And I think the hesitancy is to be far more interpretive amongst many historians. And I don't look at the archive as a suspect source. I look at more as an incredibly rich source that you can engage with in many different ways. I don't give command to any of those. There's a remarkable story in the archive I did for the material on the Citizens Welfare Service where it was a Friday afternoon. A social worker says, I left the office. I was supposed to go to Fitzroy to interview a woman. As I entered the district, the noxious smell of the Fitzroy just overwhelmed me and I had to leave and I went home. And I remember I talked about that as those, you know, different sorts of barriers, and this is the one of smell, the evil smell. But I remember I quipped in the paper, well, she says she went home, but maybe she went to the pub, maybe she met her boyfriend. And people were just outraged at that suggestion. Now, we don't know if she went home. And to suggest why would she not go home if she said in the report that she did go home, it's ludicrous because we know all the time. That's what we do as humans. So the very notion that you could suggest that it could mean something else is a threat. And I think that's the interesting part, to suggest that an aspect of an archive is fictional or embellished. Some people see that as really problematic. They would see that as an attack on the foundation of the fact-finding value of doing history.
That word home has just triggered something for me because it's a word that Derrida uses in describing the archive. Mm. Derrida is the patron saint of archive fever here.
Okay.
But he calls the archive a homecoming. It's the place to which we constantly return.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether for Indigenous people who might have a different sense of home, a different sense of place, a different sense of belonging, can the colonial archive ever represent that? What might an Indigenous archive look like?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the colonial archive itself, again, I know Aboriginal people have done remarkable work around photography in the archive. It would be used in a lot more exciting ways than traditionally. But again, the archive has served an important purpose for some Aboriginal people to find material that they need and value. But what would an Indigenous or Aboriginal archive look like? I tell you what it looks like because I've just written an essay on the Lower Yarra or the Birrarung River and the changes to that landscape from the end of the Ice Age until now. And it's a very shifting landscape, whether it be wetlands, shifting soil. So it's very ephemeral. So if you go down now and you stand on the Westgate Bridge, it's the beginning of where the old river, the Birrarung River, meets Port Phillip Bay. But what I wrote in the essay is that, in fact, the landscape itself is a living archive so that you can trace history, not just in a geological or geographic sense, that the ephemeral nature of land and where it meets water is that it's always giving you an introduction into the past, both through traces of the past and the stories that it holds. So I think country is an archival source in that sense. And again, not just doing scientific research on core samples or, you know, so-called rock art. I think it, the way that it's interpreted. One of the issues there is that after the arrival of the British in this part of the country in 1835 and permanent European settlement, the destruction of parts of the wetlands, or most of the wetlands, unfortunately, they did destroy part of an archive. And in a European or colonial sense of treasures, it would be like taking a colonial treasure and burning it and destroying it. So a lot of repository of an evidence of occupation, of story, has been destroyed because of the way that not only building on landscape, but changing dramatically the formation of landscape. And in the case of wetlands, the inability now of those soils to shift for water to find its own course. Water is now controlled in a very irrigational and sort of ornamental way.
Tony, we'll have to start wrapping things up. But before we go, I'd like to ask you one final question that we ask all our guests. You've already spoken a little bit how you've often engaged with the archive in rebellious or provocative ways that kind of...
Never rebellious.
Well, creative ways that can unsettle more sort of literal-minded historians.
Yeah.
But do you have a particular little dirty archive secret that you'd like to share?
I do have something I'd like to share, which may satisfy your listeners, is that I gave a lecture last year at Melbourne University, and if we think of objects as a repository of story and part of the archive, so it's a bit of a stretch, but not entirely. When I went into the theatre, and everything now is very modern, I noticed in the lecture theatre, they still had a very old imperial measure, a ruler on the blackboard, a 3-foot ruler. And I was looking at it while I was talking about the destruction of Aboriginal country, that this represented imperialism, this measurement represented colonialism. And at the end of the lecture, I picked the 3-foot ruler up and I held it above my head and I said, and I'm taking this with me because I'm going to take country back inch by inch. And I walked out with the ruler and took it home. And apparently there's an investigation into this at Melbourne University because someone stole the imperial ruler. But people thought that was an act of madness. But I just thought it was a beautiful moment of expression of taking back country.
So where's the ruler now? Is it still?
It's at home, and yep. If anyone from Melbourne University wants to try and claim it, just see how far you get.
Thank you, Tony, for coming into Archive Fever to chat with us today. Tony is not on Twitter or any other form of social media, so if you want to know more about his work, you'll just have to read his books.
So until next time, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian. Coming up in the next episode.
It was a really profoundly moving moment for me. It was almost kind of scary, actually, because I realised that as an archivist, as a historian, I had a power and access that was both wonderful but frightening.